is Sunday, 8th March 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched and listened to this program, you decide that you like what you have watched or heard, you wish to indicate that fact. Now, today we are entering the seventh day of the conflict, the war between the United States and Iran. American objectives remain as nebulous, at least their declared objectives, remain as nebulous and as shifting as always. Though beneath all of that, the fact that this is a regime change war, the intention to achieve regime change in Iran is essentially indisputable and all but unconcealed. And one country, one of the participants in the war, really makes no effort to conceal the fact that this is all about ultimately achieving regime change in Iran, even if the price is in effect the destruction of that country. And that party is, of course, the Israeli government, the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Now, I say that over the last few hours, the Iranian authorities have said that the successor to Ayatollah Khamenei as supreme leader of Iran has been chosen, and that there will be an announcement as to who this person is at some point today. Following that announcement, according to The Guardian in London, the Israeli authorities announced that whoever that person is, the Israelis will prioritize him. He's bound to be a man, will prioritize him as a target and seek his assassination. Now, I have to say, I find this extremely disturbing at multiple levels. This person, whoever he is, we don't yet know anything about him. We don't know what he has done in the past. We don't know what views he might have had about Iranian policy. He might, for example, have been an opponent of Iran having any kind of nuclear program at all. He might conceivably be someone who might be interested in reaching out to the United States and to Israel, reversing the current policy of no negotiations and no ceasefire. He might be someone with all sorts of intentions and plans, and whose previous record shows no involvement at all in any of the activities that Iran has actually conducted, or in those activities that Iran is blamed for by the United States and Israel, two things which, by the way, are not identical. But before the name and identity of this person is even announced, before we know anything at all about his background, before we know anything at all about his politics or policies or intentions in this critical moment, the Israeli authorities already say that they're going to kill him. Now, as I said, it amazes me how these kind of assertions, how these expressions of intention carried out with ruthless force go so completely undebated in the West. In Israel, as it happens, and as I know, they are debated and challenged and questioned an awful lot, both publicly and behind the scenes. No one in the Western media that I have seen seems to think that there is anything unusual or strange about this conduct. So this is indisputably a regime change war. If you are making it your objective to assassinate the leader of another country without knowing anything about him before even his identity and name has so far been announced, well, you are making it obvious and clear that what you are, what your objective is regime change, and that you are prepared to go to almost any lengths in order to achieve it. The trouble is that 7 days after the conflict began, regime change has not been achieved, and for the moment, there is little sign that it is about to happen. It is surely not a coincidence that after a week of this regime change military operation, leaks have started to appear in the US media, in the Washington Post to be precise, about a report from the US intelligence community that was provided to the President of the United States, in which the US intelligence community advised that however relentless the attack on Iran might be, whether it were carried out at a low level or at a very high level, absent a ground invasion of Iran and an occupation of the country, there could be no guarantee, in fact, no likelihood, that regime change in Iran could be achieved. Now, a week before the conflict began, over the weekend, at a meeting that took place apparently in the Oval Office, the president was confronted by General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the director of the CIA, John Radcliffe. And according to multiple reports that appeared in the media over the following days, both of these officials informed the president that whatever military campaign was conducted, they would be unable to guarantee, they could not guarantee that a satisfactory regime change would be achieved as a result of it. And apparently, both General Kane and Director Radcliffe were questioned at some length, to a certain extent by the President, to a much greater extent by the Vice President, J.D. Vance, whose scepticism about the entire operation no one any longer doubts. And, well, the meeting did not go well at all from the President's point of view. The President, by this time, had already decided that he would go to war. He was already committed to that war. He issued, after the reports about this meeting started to circulate in the media, an angry Truth Social post insisting that General Kane was fully a part of the team, that he would loyally fulfill orders if the order to attack Iran were ever given, and that the operation would be easy. That was what the president said. Now, everything suggests to me that the report we're reading about in the Washington Post today, which was discussed, by the way, in a masterly fashion by Larry Johnson. You can find his discussion on Sonar 21, Larry Johnson's blog. You can find it all set out there. And remember, Larry Johnson is a former CIA analyst and a veteran of the US intelligence community, and of course a member of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, one of the most excellent institutions, just to say, in the United States, the one which receives far too little attention in the United States and which is in almost entirely ignored by the media, which, by the way, I find astonishing. But that's another matter. Anyway, Larry Johnson discusses this report in detail. I have no doubt that this was the report that formed the basis of the conclusions and the arguments that Kane and Radcliffe made to the president at that meeting, and that those were the arguments which the president rejected. Well, 7 days on, and that report is starting to look prescient, or if you prefer, correct. There is, as of now, still no sign that there is any crack within the Iranian leadership, that the Iranian government is indeed about to collapse, that that regime change in Iran is going to happen. The various rumours and reports that were circulating about contacts by Mossad and the US with Iranian military officials who were preparing to rebel against the government, well, none of that has materialized up to now. And, well, we are starting to see the president and his officials, those of his officials who decided to ignore this report and to launch this war, trying to come up with some plan, any plan, to achieve at least some kind of objective in this war that they can say is a victory. Now, before I proceed, let me discuss briefly the situation with the rebellion of military units in Iran. It remains still, I suspect, just about a possibility. But with every day and week that passes, and it doesn't happen, it starts to become less likely. It seems to me that absent an all-out invasion of Iran, given that Iran continues to hold its own, it is very unlikely that such a thing will happen. And I noticed that Seymour Hersh, the US investigative reporter, who was told by one of his sources in the US intelligence community that there were indeed discussions with Iranian military officials about a possible rebellion against the government. Anyway, these people are apparently trying to explain to Seymour Hersh why this expected rebellion has not taken place, are shifting the blame on President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu by saying that the rebellion, the insurrection against the Ayatollah, was preempted by the American-Israeli attack. And the fact that that attack took place made it impossible, in effect, for these military officials to act in the way that they were supposed to do. I find this argument, and I have to say this, extraordinarily far-fetched, convoluted to say the least. Again, I'm puzzled why a journalist of Seymour Hersh's background and reputation and massive experience should fall for this one, but there it is. Anyway, there we are. We are without any sign of fracturing so far within Iranian society. No sign of a rebellion by the military. No sign that the Iranian governmental system is crumbling or close to collapse. No sign of an internal collapse for the moment in Iran. Perhaps as this battle continues, as this grinding of war of attrition goes on, something within Iran will crack. But for the moment, that isn't happening. And to repeat again, that seems to me to be leaving the president, and indeed Prime Minister Netanyahu, and their officials facing a major problem. Because, as we know, there are shortages of precision weapons in the United States. There's been a cascade of further articles in the US media, incidentally, discussing this very topic. In fact, there's been all sorts of explanations and claims as to why the mighty US industrial, military industrial complex, the arsenal of democracy and all that, isn't able to keep up with the demands of this war. I read, for example, somewhere that there is one specific bottleneck, which is one particular factory which produces the necessary chemicals that are needed for all of these weapons and which is limited in the amount of these chemicals that it can produce today. And there is a rather plaintive contrast with the way in which this same factory was able to produce similar or earlier versions of these chemicals in almost infinite numbers at the previous peak of its production in 1944 during the Second World War. Well, I think this is my own view, that it goes much beyond that. I think the problems are far more deep-seated. Alex Vershinin of the Royal United Services Institute, Brian Beletic at the New Atlas, why I myself and we on the Durand have long talked about the immense challenges, the enormous systemic difficulties that exist across the West in the production of advanced weapons, at least the production of those weapons in quantities. And, well, there are further reports of air defense missile interceptors running short. I've been seeing estimates that it might take the United States up to 8 years to replace the advanced radar systems that Iran has already destroyed across the Middle East. Just saying. Anyway, that's only one part of the problem that the president and his officials, and indeed Prime Minister Netanyahu, are facing. There are further problems, and again, we on the Durand, I on this channel, others in many places have been talking about these as well. The critical situation in global energy markets, the remorseless, relentless increase in the price of oil, the effect that this is going to have on the global economy, on the global industrial systems, especially industrial systems in vulnerable countries, which means mostly the United States, and above all, its allies in Western Europe and in Asia, in Japan, in South Korea, in the Philippines, in all of these places. Anyway, and of course, the havoc that a crisis in global energy markets can cause in the global financial system. And, well, we did a live stream on the Durand 2 days ago on Friday with Cyrus Jansen and Alex of Reportify, in which they discussed the financial implications, the implications in the derivatives markets, especially as a result of any surge in oil and energy prices. And by the way, Eve Smith and Naked Capitalism have been busy doing the same thing, and they do this superbly well, if I may say. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, Eve Smith was kind enough to steer me towards a brilliant article by a Mr. Pereira on Substack, which went into this in far more detail and explained the problems in the insurance markets caused by the closure of the Straits of Hormuz and the potentially catastrophic effects in the global financial system that all of this might lead to. So it's not difficult to see that the president and his officials, at least those of them that support the war, and Prime Minister Netanyahu and his officials in Israel, confronted by this situation, now find themselves in difficulties. So we have a whole succession of erratic and, in my opinion, frankly, bizarre comments. So President Trump has spent much of the last week throwing tempered tantrums in the direction of his once best friend, Prime Minister Keir Starmer of Britain. Starmer has entirely pointlessly, in my opinion, made a titanic effort to get on the good side of Donald Trump in order to get Trump to remain committed to Starmer's pet project, which is, of course, Project Ukraine. But the two men have now massively fallen out over Iran. Starmer, probably, if left to himself, would have joined in this enterprise. He's been criticised by Tony Blair, by the way, for not doing so. Tony Blair, of course, joined the previous enterprise, the war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, at the bidding of another US president, George W. Bush, just saying. It destroyed Blair's premiership, but in other respects, it can't be said that it's done Blair very much harm. In fact, he's prospered. But anyway, he thinks that Starmer was wrong to keep Britain out of the war. And you can find all sorts of pro-war voices, especially on the right of British politics, essentially saying the same thing, despite the fact that there is solid opposition to the war within Britain. And by the way, little liking for Donald Trump. Anyway, Starmer himself, who took this stance because of very strong opposition from within the government and legal advice that the war is illegal and a war of aggression. Anyway, Starmer has been trying to put himself back in Trump's good books. He's now been deploying some parts of Britain's greatly diminished navy at the disposal of the United States. This has resulted in another temper tantrum from Donald Trump, who says that the United States does not need Britain's navy. This is, of course, absolutely true. The British have no real force that they can add to this war over and above that which the United States and Israel are already bringing to bear. But these comments of Donald Trump's, criticising Starmer when he doesn't provide aid, and then criticising Starmer again when he seems to be about to do so, have undercut the pro-war voices in Britain. They've triggered considerable dismay, and they've led to a shocked, very upset article, in editorial to be precise, in the Daily Telegraph, the staunchest pro-war voice of all, complaining about Trump's allegedly loose tongue. Anyway, that's one example of the president, as I said, being increasingly erratic. He's also, perhaps more importantly, changing his position constantly about the Kurds. So a few days ago, there were reports in the media about the president, Donald Trump, having had a conversation with Kurdish militia leaders based in Iraqi Kurdistan, urging them to attack Iran, assuring them that air cover from the United States would be provided if they did attack Iran. There were reports that Trump's call resulted in peremptory language, basically ordering the Kurds to conduct their attack on Iran. Then, of course, reports started to circulate that the forces that the Kurds would be able to throw into the battle were not that big, that the Kurdish leaders themselves were divided about the wisdom of doing this, that the wider Kurdish community was unenthusiastic, and that there was no guarantee that the larger Kurdish community in Iran itself would support this attack. The Daily Telegraph, by the way, sent its reporter to Iraqi Kurdistan to speak with these militia leaders. The headline of the resulting article suggests that the Kurds are aching to attack Iran. But when you actually read the article itself, you quickly discover that this is far from the case and that there are many uncertainties and doubts, and also worries that, based on previous experience, the United States, if the Kurds do what is being asked of them, will eventually abandon the Kurds once again, leaving them hanging out to dry. Anyway, apparently the Kurds for the moment are unenthusiastic. Perhaps they haven't said a definite no, but they've not yet said yes. There's no word, no really reliable word so far of any actual attacks on the border, at least not for the moment. And, well, the president, Donald Trump, says that he doesn't need the Kurds after all. He doesn't think that the Kurds should attack Iran. This is never his idea. If the Kurds did attack Iran, it would already make a complicated business even more complicated. And, well, for the moment, they are not needed. And, of course, all of this completely inconsistent with the previous reports that the president himself had been urging the Kurds to attack Iran. Reports, incidentally, which no one in the administration that I know of actually ever denied. Just saying. So, the president, it was his idea that the Kurds should not attack. Nothing to do with them. But, of course, previously, it was his idea that they should attack. Well, you could say that he's changed his mind, but I don't think anybody would say that. Anyway, the president still then goes on to say that he's not interested in talking to the Iranians. He wants unconditional surrender. He wants the war to end in some kind of Iranian capitulation. He wants to be the person who chooses the supreme leader and all of that. But then, of course, that disregards the fact that even as the president has been changing and shifting his ground on this constantly, and I've seen reports that there have been as many as three requests from the United States to Iran for a ceasefire, the entirely consistent, the completely consistent Iranian position is that they are not interested in a ceasefire with the United States, that they no longer trust the United States, that they don't want to negotiate with the United States, that they need to put themselves, as they say, in a position of advantage over the United States, such as when there is what the Russians refer to not as a ceasefire, but as a cessation of hostilities. This time it will be once and forever. Well, but the president, he doesn't want to say that it's the Iranians who are rejecting a ceasefire. So, of course, he comes out and says that it is him. Now, in the meantime, we continue to see a constant pattern of escalation. Yesterday, I read with deep concern that the Israelis have conducted an attack on a desalination plant within Iran. I don't know exactly what took place over the course of this attack. The report was Iranian. It might not be true. But then I'm not aware that the Israelis themselves have denied it. Inevitably, attacks on desalination plants inside Israel by the Iranians then appear to have followed. I read somewhere, and this might be an overstatement of the truth, maybe a huge overstatement of the truth, that Israel depends for around a third of its fresh water on desalination plants. I would have thought it was extremely unwise for Israel to conduct attacks on Iranian desalination plants. Obviously, Iran relies, is heavily dependent on these plants in some places. Fresh water is no doubt needed in many of the great cities of Iran, but they are needed in Israel as well. And however great Israel's dependence is on desalination plants, the dependence of the Arab Gulf states, above all Saudi Arabia, on desalination plants to keep fresh water, to supply fresh water to the great Saudi cities, to Riyadh and Jeddah and all of the others, is enormous. If attacks upon these desalination plants by Iran start to happen, well, I don't want to even start to think what the consequences or the effect of that would be. I hope that it never comes to that, but we are now at the early stages of seeing exactly this thing. Now, here I come back to my program yesterday. I dedicated a large part of yesterday's program rebutting the claims that were circulating across the Western media yesterday, and which were seized on by Donald Trump himself, that the Iranian president Masoud Pezeshkian had announced a change of policy, a policy whereby Iran would cease further attacks upon the Gulf states, the Arab states, unless supposedly attacks in those states, from the bases in those states, were being conducted, positively conducted, against Iran. I said yesterday that Pezeshkian's words, made over the course of a television address to the Iranian people, which was an address of defiance, an address that said Iran would not and would never surrender, were being over and misinterpreted. Well, that turned out to be absolutely true. Various Iranian officials criticized Pezeshkian for his sloppy language. The Iranian military, as I said yesterday, basically contradicted the impression that was circulating about Pezeshkian's words. And in fact, attacks on infrastructure facilities across the Gulf states continue unabated at exactly the level, as far as I can see, that they were taking place yesterday and the day before and throughout the last week. There has, in other words, been no slackening off of Iranian attacks against these targets. If the leaders of the Gulf states hoped that the interpretation of Pezeshkian's words that was circulating in the media was true, then they discovered very quickly that their hopes had been disappointed. Anyway, there it is. Now, if we see constant escalation, Who is to say, especially if the Gulf states are unwise enough to engage Iran itself in this war, that Iran will not retaliate with attacks against the Arab desalination plants, at which point we will have a crisis in the Arabian Peninsula of simply unimaginable proportions. I mean a humanitarian crisis of unimaginable proportions. And, well, given the lack of wisdom of any Israeli attacks on Iranian desalination plants, and let me stress again that up to this time, the only report I've seen that this attack on the Iranian desalination plant took place comes from Iran itself. Well, putting all that aside, we also see, and this is indisputable, Israeli attacks on Iranian oil facilities, oil storage facilities, and oil refining facilities, clearly also intended to create a crisis within Iran, to implode its economy, to create within Iran an economic and political crisis, which would presumably lead to the collapse of the government and perhaps eventually to regime change, though I wonder now whether pure destruction within Iran has become the objective. Now, putting aside again one's concerns about the moral implications of this, the strategy here seems to me once again deeply unwise. Yesterday, reports started to appear that China is prepared to extend economic, financial aid to Iran, as well as to help Iran by providing spare parts for some of its weapon systems, perhaps its launchers, just saying. The Russians also have been providing Iran with economic assistance. I've discussed in previous programs that a little known fact is that Russia actually exports energy, oil and gas to Iran, something which many find surprising, but which is something that the Russians unquestionably do. So it could be that the Russians will continue to supply Iran with energy products, at least at a sufficient level to keep the Iranian economy ticking along so that Iran can continue the war, and that this attack, these attacks on the oil facilities might not have the intended effect of creating a crisis within Iran. But what they might do is something else. We are now starting to see clear evidence that Iran itself is attacking oil installations across the Middle East, and potentially it might start conducting attacks on oil storage and refining facilities inside Israel itself. All this at a time when the West is already facing a potential oil shortage because of the closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Well, what will that effect be? I mean, again, one has to look at scale. Iran, because it is a huge country, functions on an entirely different scale to Israel. It can absorb massive damage to its energy system, And it is backed by one of the world's biggest oil producers, which is, of course, Russia. Israel, by contrast, is a small country. It does produce some oil, as I understand it, but not enough to cover its own needs. And though it is backed by another country, the United States, which is a major oil producer and exporter, it is fair to say that the United States is much more sensitive to pricing issues in the international energy markets than Russia is, and has commitments to export oil to all sorts of places, which may extend, and which will increasingly extend, its potential production and its ability to keep all of its customers supplied. I would have thought that in a long war, it was inadvisable for Israel to conduct attacks on the Iranian energy system. Just saying. Now, I say Israel, perhaps I'm running too far ahead. Maybe these attacks on the oil facilities and the refineries were at least in part the work of the United States. It is now acknowledged that the strike on the school, the one which resulted in the deaths of, I believe, up to 170 schoolgirls, that strike was carried out by the United States. I continue to believe that strike was unintentional. The US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, denies that the United States, says that the United States would never have conducted an attack of that kind. Apparently, however, internal investigations in the United States, including internal government investigations within the United States, are increasingly coming to the conclusion that it was indeed an American missile that struck the school, under the mistaken impression that it was a building that was part of a nearby Iranian base. However, the US government is finding its position undermined, because again, the president and some of his officials continue to claim that it was an Iranian missile that carried out this attack. I'm not sure whether they're saying that this was a false flag. All of the information that exists strongly argues against that, or whether they believe that or not, who knows? But anyway, it could be, on the basis of what happened in that school, a lot of the early reports suggested that it was an Israeli missile, but it now is definitely established, or definitely alleged, perhaps, that it was an American missile. Well, maybe the attacks on the oil facilities in Iran were also the work of the United States, which, again, to repeat, still makes it extraordinarily unwise in light of the fact that we are now on the brink of what looks like a major oil crisis, a major oil and energy crisis. Well, these attacks are already very, very alarming, but perhaps because the Kurdish operation it cannot proceed, we're now starting to get information trickling out of the United States that suggests a different objective. The seizure of Kharg Island, an island in the Persian Gulf, where Iranian oil terminals are located, and which is used by Iran to process most of the oil that it exports and to load it onto the various ships that export that oil. Now, I remember that Harg Island was a major issue of contention during the 1980s in the long conflict between Iran and Iraq, just saying. So this isn't entirely new. And I do wonder whether the reports that are circulating about the cancellation of exercises by the 82nd Airborne Division in the United States aren't connected in some way with this plan. With the Kurds apparently unwilling to attack Iran or showing hesitation about doing so, maybe the plan now is to seize Harg Island, to use the 82nd Airborne Division to do that, and hope that this somehow creates a crisis in Iran and leads to the collapse of the government there. And given US behavior, the US policies towards Venezuela, the way in which the United States has in effect appropriated to itself the right to export and sell Venezuela's oil, just saying. Well, might it be that there is a plan being hatched within the Trump administration to establish some kind of permanent control of Harg Island on the part of the United States so as to gain indefinite control of Iran's oil exports? I'm going to say straight away that I am not a military person, as I have discussed many times, but to me, already this looks like a lunatic plan. Harg Island is, of course, an island. I don't know what the size of any Iranian garrison is there, but it is relatively small. Any American military force deployed to seize Harg Island is well within the range of Iranian short-range missiles and drones. The potential for heavy casualties seems to me to be obvious. The US Navy would not be in a position to provide immediate support because it cannot navigate through the Straits of Hormuz, which are closed and, as has been in effect admitted by the US Navy itself, they are very, very reluctant to get too close to the Straits of Hormuz, because if they did, their own warships might be vulnerable to attack by Iranian drones and missiles. So, unless there's something I don't understand, unless there's some idea that deployment of the third carrier, the George H.W. Bush, is going to provide the United States with enough naval power to force the Straits of Hormuz, maybe that is possible. But it still seems to me very high risk. But anyway, unless there is something here that I don't understand, it seems to me that an operation to seize Harg Island is extraordinarily problematic, to say the least. It risks concentrating US forces in one place, Harg Island, where conceivably they could be a relatively straightforward target for Iranian missiles. We have all of these plans, all of these ideas coming out one after the other, tumbling around one after the other, but a coherent military strategy, of that I see no sign. A coherent political strategy, of that I see no sign either. I've often discussed in many programs, stretching all the way back to the start of the special military operation in Ukraine by Russia in February 2022, Clausewitz and his famous dictum that war is an extension of politics. Well, this war, the one that we are seeing now, appears to me to be a war waged without any heed to that doctrine whatsoever. If there really were a plan to shift or change the policies of the Iranian government, everything that I have seen so far is not going to achieve it. In fact, everything suggests that instead it is going to make that government even more hardline. Now, I don't know where all of this is going. Larry Johnson says it will take at least 2 weeks for the 82nd Airborne Division to arrive in the Middle East. And, well, I don't know whether there is a plan to capture Khard Island and what that plan would involve. But I cannot imagine that this can be done by the 82nd Airborne Division by itself. There are other, it seems to me, equally harebrained plans circulating. A few weeks ago, until a few weeks ago, the President of the United States and his officials were continuing to insist that Iran's nuclear enrichment program had been totally obliterated as a result of the June 2025 12-day war, and specifically as a result of the American bombing of the Iranian facilities in Natanz, Isfahan, and Fordow. Now, I'm reading in the media that there are concerns that Iran's enriched uranium is hidden somewhere inside a secret tunnel, perhaps somewhere close to the Isfahan facility, and that there is a plan to send a special forces unit to seize that enriched uranium before the Iranians themselves remove it. Well, that might be a sensible plan. I mean, I'm not saying that the US special forces are not able to do those things. I've learned from experience that it is unwise to underestimate what US special forces are capable of doing. But who in their senses announces an operation of that kind weeks ahead of when such an operation can take place in the media? There is one last thing which continues for me to show the extraordinary bafflement and bewildering, almost zany nature of the way in which the political leadership of the United States up to this time is conducting this war. Yesterday, there was circulating what seemed to me extremely plausible reports that Iran was receiving assistance from Russia in targeting US bases. And I explained yesterday in my program why I thought those reports were plausible. I would add that since then, since I did my video yesterday, I received a private email, again, from the same source who is familiar with the discussions that are taking place at an unclassified level, I should stress this, within the Duma, the Russian parliament. And this source says that there's been significant discussion about the conflict in Iran there, though members of the Duma, unsurprisingly, remain much more focused about Ukraine. And this source also said to me that though the Russians have not given so far direct warnings to Azerbaijan and Armenia to stay out of the conflict between Israel, the United States, and Iran, they have advised those governments that it would be in their own interests to avoid doing so. It was a very interesting email altogether. Well, President Trump was asked about whether there was evidence that Russia might be providing assistance to Iran to strike American targets. And he said, no such evidence exists. Despite reports in the US media, in the Washington Post, that the US intelligence community has concluded that Russia is providing that help, the president has seen no evidence of it. Well, that might be true, but then we had further comments by the president's representative, his envoy for all things, Steve Witkoff. And Steve Witkoff is saying that he warned the Russians against providing intelligence to Iran, which for me begs the obvious question of when exactly did he do that? Did he do that when he met Putin in the Kremlin together with Jared Kushner on the 23rd of January of this year? Did he do that in the various meetings in Abu Dhabi? Did he do that at the meeting that took place in February in Geneva when the chief Russian negotiator was the formidable Vladimir Medinsky? Did he do that in his various conversations with Kirill Dmitriev? Did it not occur to him that if he did, the Russians would undoubtedly treat that as confirmation that the United States was indeed about to attack Iran and would have undoubtedly alerted Iran to that fact? Of course, if Witkoff gave this warning to the Russians, to Medinsky and Kostyukov during the meeting in Geneva, when the Americans, when Witkoff himself was shuttling from one meeting, the meeting with the Russians and the Ukrainians, to another meeting, the meeting with the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. Well, it would in that case have been even more bizarre. I don't believe that Witkoff ever gave the Russians any such warning. And for me, that undercuts the whole story being put about by Trump that the Russians that he hasn't seen no evidence that the Russians are providing intelligence support to Iran. For the president to admit that would mean admitting that another great power is now involved with the conflict, a great power with similar technological and industrial capabilities to those of the United States itself, a great power, Russia, which is backed by a still greater great power, which is, of course, China. And I can completely understand why, given all the ongoing problems of the existing operation, the president does not want to admit that. But to me, I still find it plausible that that is indeed what the Russians are doing. And this strange melange of stories again highlights the extent to which the president and his officials really do not know at this moment in time what to do and are making it up as they go along. Now, in saying all of these things, it continues to be the case that something might turn up, and it could be that the president's gigantic gamble in starting this war pays off. I've discussed many times that I am not familiar with the internal situation in Iran. Iran remains stable, at least outwardly, but it may be that there are beneath the surface disagreements and disputes. It may be that there is more opposition to the government in Iran than we can see. It may be that all of this breaks out into the surface. And there is no doubt at all that Iran is indeed suffering significant damage. There's lots of reports, for example, putting aside the attacks on Iranian infrastructure, the many deaths that the Iranians are experiencing, but there's many reports that Iran is losing large numbers of launchers. Now, this is a problem. I read an article by Simplicius the Thinker in which he spoke about launchers as being simply trucks and not the same as missiles, and how trucks can be easily replaced. Nothing like that is remotely true. I find it surprising that Simplicius the Thinker could say this. The type of vehicles that are designed to launch long-range missiles, the kind of long-range missiles that can strike targets in Israel and elsewhere in the Middle East, these are not simple trucks. They are extremely sophisticated vehicles which can sometimes take a very, very long time to produce. So the Israelis and the Americans are claiming that they managed to destroy large numbers of these. The information that they've provided to confirm this, however, is not uncontested. The Iranians themselves say that most of the launchers that the Israelis and the Americans claim to have destroyed are decoys, and perhaps they are. Anyway, some at least have been destroyed, and even China and Russia would struggle to replace them, especially as, I assume, launchers have to be capable of launching specific missiles. And of course, the Russians and the Chinese might not produce launchers that are suitable to launch Iranian missiles. So it could be that cumulatively, over time, the pressures on Iran become so strong that there is a crisis and a collapse in Iran, and the president comes out a winner. But I have to say that with every week that passes, and that doesn't happen, it starts to look less likely. And at some point, perhaps 3 weeks from now, we will reach that point where it is realistic to say that it is very unlikely to happen at all. And then that begs the question of what does the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu and all of the others, what do they do in a situation like that? It's difficult to imagine that any agreement for an off-ramp proposed by the Russians and agreed by the Iranians would not at that point be perceived as a defeat for Israel and for the United States, in which case the entire political geography of the Middle East changes forever, and the international position of the United States is severely undermined. Moreover, by that point, we might be in the grip of a full-fledged economic crisis, which will undermine not just the international position of the United States, but which will destroy the president's domestic political position in advance of the midterms. This is the high stakes that the president is facing at the moment. Perhaps, in light of all of this, it isn't so surprising that the president and Witkoff and others like him, I'm not going to even start with Pete Hegseth, who it seems to me is behaving so erratically that, frankly, I think someone should tell him to take a vacation and to absent himself completely from the decision-making process. Anyway, I don't find it surprising that all of these people are starting to behave in this very strange, erratic way. Maybe they should have listened to the information that they were given by Radcliffe and Kane at that meeting. In fact, of course they should have done. They should also perhaps read an article which has appeared in the Financial Times today, written by the former president of the Council for Foreign Relations in the United States, Richard Haass, who says that this is a war of choice. By the way, that is a horrible euphemism. All wars of any kind are wars of choice. Even when a country is attacked, if it decides to fight, it is engaged in a war of choice. It is making a choice to avoid war. In March 1939 and August 1968, Czechoslovakia, which was attacked on both of those occasions, made a choice which was that it would capitulate rather than fight. A controversial decision in both cases within Czechoslovakia, but that was the choice of the Czechoslovak leadership on both of those cases. So all wars, even wars when countries defend themselves against aggression, are wars of choice. Even countries that have been attacked have to make a choice whether they're going to defend themselves or not. What Richard Haass means about this war, when he calls it a war of choice as opposed to a war of necessity, what he actually means is that it is a war of aggression, and we should not engage in these kind of euphemisms. Just saying. But anyway, even Richard Haass admits that this kind of war is going to have to end sooner or later with an outcome that falls far below the kind of objectives that the president and his officials have set themselves. And it is very, very difficult to see how that can be packaged as anything else, at least this is my view, not Richard Haass's, as anything less than a defeat. If you launch this kind of attack and it ends with that sort of outcome, then it is a defeat. The alternative is for the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu to go on escalating, but escalating to what level and to what point? Well, I'm going to say, I think well before the ultimate political point is reached, certainly in the United States, but I believe in Israel itself, more rational actors will step in and will finally put a stop to the whole business in ways that lead to the political demise of Trump, Netanyahu, and all of the people that I've discussed who are involved. But anyway, this is an incredible gamble that they plunged into. Clearly, they did not understand Iran very well. Every proposal that they've been coming up with up to now, which I've discussed, all of the things that they're doing up to now, attacks on desalination plants, attacks on oil refineries, attempts to involve the Kurds, attempts to seize Haag Island, all of those things taken together, special forces operations, have about them, at least for me, a look of desperation. And, well, when people start to become desperate, they behave in an unpredictable and dangerous way. And as I said, I hope those more rational forces do finally step in before the most irrational and dangerous decisions of all are made. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish my discussion of the situation in Iran, in the conflict in Iran today. I would add just one thing, which is that the Iranians themselves, it seems, still are holding back on some of the potential escalation that they could conduct. I still remain sceptical about Iran's ability to strike the US Navy carriers. I know that there is a lot of discussion of this, and I would add that the destruction of a US Navy carrier could have unpredictable results in the United States. And, well, I don't want to speculate too much about those, but that might itself be an inhibiting factor for the Iranian leadership. But beyond that, frankly, I don't think they can do it. One thing they probably can do is attack Israel's Dimona facility, its nuclear facility at Dimona. Now, what the effect of that would be, I don't again want to speculate about or guess, but certainly if we arrive at that kind of point, then we're looking at a very serious escalatory step by Iran. But even more pressing is the fact that the Iranians so far have not announced what their political objectives in the war are. They clearly have a strategy, which is an endurance strategy, which so far is working. But what is the political strategy which lies behind it? I'm assuming that they have one. They give the impression that they do, but they have not yet set out their terms for an end to the war. They've not said what would persuade them to stop. There's many speculations about the Iranians wanting a withdrawal, a complete withdrawal of US forces from the Middle East. That might be very, very difficult to get the Americans to agree to, by the way. At some point, the Iranians if this war drags on, are going to have to say what it is they want to achieve. And until that happens, we're all guessing. And, well, the absence of clearly defined Iranian objectives sets question marks over Iran and also makes one wonder whether the Iranians themselves have an exit plan in this war. But anyway, let's wait and see. And as I said, this is the end of my discussion up to this point. Now, I want to return briefly to a discussion to finish this program by returning briefly to Sergei Lavrov's words yesterday, which I discussed yesterday, about the negotiations, the state of the negotiations in Anchorage. I should say that Gordon Hahn has again written an excellent article discussing these comments of Lavrov. One thing that perhaps I didn't convey clearly enough in my program yesterday is how defensive Lavrov's words were. He acknowledged that, especially following the attack on Iran, there is mounting criticism in Russia of the negotiations between Russia and the United States, that many people in Russia are becoming extremely critical of the entire negotiating process, the meeting in Anchorage, the various meetings in Abu Dhabi and Istanbul and Geneva, the conversations between Putin and Trump, the meetings between Witkoff and Dmitriev, and all of that. So Lavrov acknowledged that the criticism is getting stronger, though he tried to create the impression that this criticism comes exclusively from outside the Russian leadership, something which, by the way, I think is wrong. Lavrov himself has in recent interviews and press conferences echoed exactly some of the criticisms that he said in his latest comments have been made by the critics. So this is a very defensive response from Lavrov, saying that people who are making these criticisms don't understand what exactly has been taking place in the negotiations, that an actual concrete agreement was reached between the Russians and the Americans in Anchorage, that the Russians are sticking by that agreement, but that the spirit of Anchorage, which is to say any goodwill that existed at the time of the meeting in Anchorage, that that has in effect melted away. Well, looking, rereading Lavrov's words, I wonder whether what the Russians are now doing, whether the message that they're now starting to circulate is that Anchorage has ultimately failed, that the Americans have been unable to act or have been unwilling to act on whatever agreement it was that they made with the Russians in Anchorage. Lavrov is careful to say that the Russians are not going to make any concessions beyond that agreement. And of course, whatever that agreement was, it's absolutely obvious that Zelensky is rejecting it, that the Europeans, as Lavrov himself said, are rejecting it, and that the Americans are not acting upon it. I, for my part, am actually sceptical about whether there was, in fact, any real agreement between the Americans and the Russians in Anchorage at all. I think that Putin structured and methodical man that he is simply could not understand, did not understand that the Americans are perfectly capable, or this administration is perfectly capable of telling him one thing and of telling the Ukrainians and the Europeans something completely different. And anything that the administration says, even if it is put down in writing, carries little weight or meaning. I think Putin went into that meeting in Anchorage under the impression that he'd achieved some kind of positive outcome, even a breakthrough, and that it has taken him many months since then to come to realize that this is not the case, and that whatever it was that Trump and Witkoff said to him in Anchorage, they didn't really mean. And I think that this statement by Lavrov is in effect a first step, or not even a first step, but another step by the Russian leadership to begin to put distance between themselves and what I suspect is widely seen now in Moscow as a debacle. The entire pointless negotiating process with the United States. Besides, the Russians must be looking at the situation in Ukraine. They are aware that the military situation on the front lines has changed radically since Anchorage, that Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Gulyapolye, all of these places have now fallen, that the Russians are largely in control of Konstantinovka, likely to capture Liman and Sviatogorsk in the north fairly soon, and are breaking through in Zaporozhye region. And that the Ukrainians are clearly showing growing signs of panic because weapons, supplies and attention is being diverted towards the Middle East. So I'm going to suggest that probably for the rest of the year, we are going to see no further diplomatic engagement over Ukraine between Russia and the United States at all. It is very striking, and I think I made this point yesterday, that since they last spoke in December, at the point when the attack on Valdai was taking place, since that telephone conversation, there had been no further direct interactions between Putin and Trump at all. Putin has not sought to discuss with Trump the situation in the Middle East. I think that says, perhaps more than anything, that relations between the United States and Russia are in effect in a state of collapse and are likely to remain so. Well, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Please remember, if you've liked this programme, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.